All right, April 19th, 2025, Bayagiri Monastery, and we've got a gathering happening. You hadn't figured that out already. So there was going to be some Bayagiri monks, Bayagiri Ajahns visiting anyway at this time. So we thought, well, why not invite some more? Have an Bayagiri reunion. So most of everybody here is an Bayagiri monk, ordained at Bayagiri. We've got quite a community built up over the years. And to make it to stick it out and not give up. So five vasas, to not give up for five vasas, to make it past five vasas, that's not easy. That's not easy to do. And that entails going through hardships and making mistakes and failures, undergoing failures and coming up against our shortcomings, coming up against ourselves. And then 10 vasas, it's not easy. Not easy to make it to that point. And the holy life is not easy. It's a struggle. But it has its rewards. It's very rewarding, very gratifying. And I know in this moment, it's very gratifying to see everybody here. And people who have just arrived, Ajahn Kantiko, Ajahn Kovilo, Ajahn Nisibo, just arrived. And yeah, it's just really wonderful. Wonderful to see. And this is built up over time. And every single one of us has had to overcome obstacles. So this room is, if you look at all the people in robes in this room, then it's a group of people who have had to actually overcome all sorts of obstacles and actually come up against themselves. So over time, what happens is we might come to this through some sort of inspiration. Actually, people come to it through a few reasons. Some people come to it through suffering, such as myself. I would be classed as one of those who came to the holy life through suffering. Some people come to it through inspiration. So maybe they didn't have much suffering in their lives, but got super inspired and saw the benefits of renunciation. And some people come to the holy life through wanting to dedicate merit. So this is more common in Thailand, wanting to dedicate the goodness of an ordination, perhaps a temporary ordination, or even more of a longer term ordination, to one's family, one's mother and father, those who gave life to us. So I would say there's those three main reasons why we come to the robes, why we ordain. But however we come to it, eventually we're going to come up against ourselves. If we stick with it for long enough, we're going to come up against ourselves and we're going to see, all right, so yeah, maybe there's all these things I'm inspired by to come to the holy life, but then the mind and the body, these are not ideal conditions. And so there might be things in the mind we don't want to look at, but they're there nonetheless. So to be very, very honest with ourselves and to be very humble. And eventually, if we practice long enough, we'll be able to give rise to an affect of friendliness. This is in Thai, like this phrase, like Quam Ben Mita Pap. It's affect of friendliness. And to have an affect of friendliness, it entails that we're humble. Because if we're not humble, then we're going to put up a hard shell around ourselves and there's going to be a sense of resistance. And we won't be able to have that metta. If there's resistance and say somebody criticizes us or points out one of our shortcomings, and if we're not humble and we don't have a sense of integrity, then we won't be able to actually accept that. And we might put up a hard resistance to that and think, then the self, the atta, it rises up in all its glory, and then it resists. And that's why the Buddha said we need to pay attention to perceptions of resistance. So those perceptions of resistance that are coming up, that's very linked to the sense of self. And so when we see that, we might think, okay, well, I need to look at my Sakkaya Ditti. I need to look at my personality belief, my personality view, my sense of self, and kind of work at that, chip away at that, because the Buddha teaches that that's one of the things that falls away at stream entry, so I need to actually work away at that. Or we might think, the Buddha says, attachment to rites and rituals falls away at stream entry, so I need to work at that. Or we might think, oh, doubt falls away at stream entry, so I need to work on that. I need to directly focus on that. But then as we spend more time in the robes and actually integrate the precepts and integrate the life, and it becomes part of us, and our character gets transformed into one who is the samana, or one who is seeking that sense of cleanliness and purity of heart, then we start to see that those things don't disappear through focusing on them directly, but those fall away as a byproduct of the insight into impermanence. So we don't really need to, sometimes we can actually strengthen the sakkayaditti, strengthen the personality view through looking at it and trying to, say, get rid of it, because it doesn't really work like that. Sometimes we try to, say, get rid of the silabhata paramasa, the attachment of rites and rituals, through saying, oh, well, okay, so I won't bow, I won't chant those things. That's silabhata paramasa, that's attachment to rites and rituals. It's actually far more subtle than that, because religiously not bowing and religiously not chanting is also silabhata paramasa. So it's not about not doing those things, but it's about the way we hold things. So we look at the clinging, we look at how clinging causes suffering, we look at the way we're holding things. So all of us over time, as we stick with this, then eventually we come up against ourselves, meaning we look at how are we clinging to things, how are we holding things. And for people who might be new here, new guests or whatnot, we're kind of, you know, we're drawn to the monastery for a certain reason. And for those of us who keep coming back, then we're drawn here for a certain reason, or we keep coming back for a certain reason. And for those of us who stay for years, we stay for a certain reason. And that's really because it's through the practice. When we overcome the obstacles, when we fall down and get back up, when we fail and we learn how to deal with those failures honorably, then that creates a certain energy, the sila, the atmosphere of practice. So sometimes we might call this the Dhamma Ramana, the Tama Rom, or the Arom Kamatan, the scent, the feeling of practice, or the attitude of practice. So when there's the attitude of practice and we're actually have that intention to come up and face up to ourselves through the practice, that creates a certain energy or a certain feeling that people naturally want to tap into. And it's kind of like it says in the suttas that what is wonderful and amazing about the Dhamma, one of the wonderful and amazing qualities of the Dhamma is that it asks people to go against their desires, and people actually want to do it. Mm. That's a wonderful and amazing quality of the Dhamma. And it's almost kind of perplexing, because the nature of desire is that it doesn't want to be called into question. Desire itself doesn't want to go away. And if desire could go away by being fulfilled, then it wouldn't be desire. We can think about that for a minute. If desire could go away by being fulfilled, it wouldn't be desire, because the nature of desire is to perpetuate itself. It's one thing we come to over time. Those types of insights, they only appear over time. So here's another one for you. There's no substitute for experience. We might want to gain experience quickly through, say, practicing harder or putting forth more effort, and yet there's no shortcut to experience. The only way to gain experience is through experience, so more experience. And as we learn, as we gain experience over time, then we can reflect on those experiences. That's one part of mindfulness. Interestingly, in the suttas, the Buddha talks about one of the ways he defines mindfulness is remembering what one heard and saw even a long time ago. So it's connected with memory. We can see through the suttas that mindfulness is connected with memory. I don't know if we could translate it exactly as the word memory, but it has to do with recollection. And then it gets paired with sampajanya. So over time, we learn what is mindfulness, because we hear about mindfulness, mindfulness meditation, and so on. And sometimes it's not clear. It's a bit murky. What is mindfulness? Similarly, what is letting go? It's a bit murky. Like, just let go. Come on, just let go. And what does that mean? And let go into what? So mindfulness, when we say establishing mindfulness, that means we're reminding ourselves to do something. And what are we reminding ourselves to do? we're reminding ourselves to be aware. That's the sampajanya part. So sati, sampajanya, those go together. And then another word that commonly gets combined with sati is panya, sati panya. So that's mindfulness and discernment. Or we could say recollection into discernment, or recollection to discern. So recollection to be aware, the reminder of ourselves to be aware, that's what we call establishing mindfulness. And we could say the reminder to discern, to wisely discern what's occurring in the moment, and ultimately to wisely discern and remind ourselves to discern impermanence in the moment. So with this a big gathering, a coming together, I also want to talk about metta a little bit, because I think I've come up with the best translation of metta, better than anybody else's translation. Well, this will be really controversial, but it's the best translation for metta, and nobody can argue with it. So I translate metta as pure love these days. This is the translation for metta that I like these days, just because I believe I have come into contact with, say, had been close to Kruba Ajahn's in Thailand a little bit, and actually think that I've been on the receiving end of their metta, and that's the feeling of it. That's the feeling tone of it. So to say not just love, but pure love, as opposed to impure love, which would be raga tanha, but pure love has no agenda to it. It's just wanting others to be happy. That's all. Don't even have to like them. You don't have to like somebody to have pure love for them. So to have metta, we talk about having metta for the whole world. And I've even heard people say, yeah, I can easily have metta for everybody except that one person, or except that world leader, or so on. But that's not it. Then that already ruins the energy of it. If we think like that, that already isn't metta for the whole world. It has to be, if it's pure love, it's unconditional. It's a Brahmavihara. It's something that makes the mind very, very bright. And so when we think of brightness, we can also think of that word purity, fresh. It's fresh. It's always fresh. The Kruba Ajahn's are fresh. We could say that too. That's kind of a cool way to think of it. So that sense of goodwill, seeing people greeting each other, seeing the big extended family, the monastic community coming together, greeting each other with metta, with a sense of mitapap, with a sense of friendliness, that's very special. And that's built up over time. That's through a shared camaraderie with each other. Just thinking of how many of the monks here, of how many nights we've stayed up on the Wanpras just together, and so many, lost count. And just that sense of shared difficulty, but also the shared joys of the practice. And it's very real. It's very human. It's not theoretical. So we're not just studying. We're not just studying the books, but we're living it. Getting up for the morning pujas. Sometimes it's not easy. Most of the time it's not easy. Having to come up against the hindrances. And it's not easy. It's not fun. It's embarrassing if we're nodding in front of everybody. And yet that doesn't mean we shouldn't come and do the meditation. We come and do it. We do it when we're tired. When we don't want to practice, we practice. When we want to practice, we practice. So this is a sense of shared camaraderie, shared difficulties. And then we have these little victories, that time that we were able to let go. And so what is letting go? Letting go is skillful response. Letting go is coupled with wisdom. So that's skillful response. So when we learn how to respond skillfully, because if we let go, say we let go of one thing, it's like we're just going to pick up something else. The mind, if there's a vacuum in the mind, something else is just going to get pulled into it. It's more about skillful response. So if we hear something disagreeable, for example, hear or see something disagreeable, and then that it might be irritating or annoying to us, or we might come into contact with a frustrating situation. And so when we see that we're irritated, annoyed, frustrated, and so on, or even angry or full of some sort of rage or a desire for something to the point where we can't stop thinking about the food we want, or if we're a monastic, then the thing we might want to get offered, or so on, or even the robes we want, the desires can go there too, getting the robe color just right. And if we are able to let go of those little victories where we're actually able to drop it, or really truly able to drop it, think of how many times that those of us together here where I've said, okay, I want to do things this way, and then say another monk wants to do it another way, and then I can see that resistance in the mind. I can see that resistance in the mind, and then actually just courageously saying, no, I'm going to totally drop it 100%. And just the lightness that comes from that. And that's a small victory. And we build those up. We build those up over time. And it's so interesting because it's so much better when we let go. So why the resistance? Why the needing to get it our way? It's so much lighter. It's so much better. It's, oh, what a relief. I don't have to worry about that anymore. I don't have to make an issue about that anymore. So why is there that resistance? Why do we need to get things our way if letting go of it is better every time? And it always will be better if we let go. So why do we keep holding on? So this is just because it's a habit. It's a habit. So we need our Dhamma friends. We need support. We need support for overcoming these habits. And we all have these habits. I'm actually amazed, you know, as the community grows, that every single person, we all have our own karmic baggage, and it's always different. And no matter how good or talented someone might be coming into the community, there's always going to be some sort of different karmic baggage to work with. Everybody comes into this with it. So there's no expectation that people are going to come in and be the kind of elite. We only want the elite, only want the elite practitioners. This is more like, I've said it before, the Mighty Ducks, like the kind of a bunch of guys just trying to move forward somehow. And but if we work together, we can win the championship. If we all learn to work together with our wide variety of personalities and different temperaments and even different views on Dhamma based on our different temperaments, and yet we can still work together. Some of us might be more faith types, some might be more thinking types, some might be more greed types, some might be more faith types. There's different personalities that come into this, but the Dhamma, if we practice long enough, the Dhamma can express itself through any of those character types. Any of those character types is going to shine with goodness if the Dhamma is followed, if the Dhamma is practiced. It doesn't really matter what the character type is. The faith type might be someone who's full of faith and able to put a lot of energy into the practice, but the drawback of the faith type is sometimes believing whatever we hear. Sometimes we should doubt certain things. Sometimes we shouldn't believe everything we hear. The anger type, judgmental and critical all the time, everybody, including themselves. But then that can be used for discernment, sharp discernment and clarity. And even one of Tan Ajahn Mun's most senior disciples, Ajahn Cao, he was known for his anger, actually. He was, as a layman, he was an incredibly angry person. And also as a monk, he was very, very angry. He would get very angry, and then he would turn the anger back to himself. And Ajahn Mun would go up to him and say, Cao, you're a good person. Why are you angry with a good person? But then later on, he was famed for his metta, for his incredible metta. And there's a story of Lungpo Cha taking Ajahn Sumedho to go see different Kruba Ajahns. They went to see Ajahn Cao when he was on his deathbed. He was about to pass away from this very severe illness. Those of you who have seen pictures of him during this illness, his jaw is all sunk in and it just looks really extreme. And Ajahn Sumedho is just probably at that time Tan Sumedho. And so when Lungpo Sumedho recollects this, he says, oh yeah, that's so powerful, the metta. And just he was just beaming. Just his eyes were just so bright and he was in so much pain and dying. But he's just unbelievably radiant. So much metta is overpowering. And then Ajahn Cao kind of say, hey, come over here. I have a teaching for you. And he said, it's all here. It's in the heart. It's here. That was his teaching. So for then Tan Sumedho. So it's things like that that we experience over time. And many of us here, if we stick with it, we've got the opportunity to go to Thailand and England and see these different monasteries and continue that path of learning. And those of us who go to Thailand, we see everybody who's gone to Thailand has learned so much. You get to go to Phujomgom and Daodam. And then all of us here, we have those shared experiences. We could talk about what our experiences at Daodam. How was it when you went to Daodam? Did you experience any animals? Did you see any tigers? So we can still experience this. It's a living tradition. So it's very much alive. And for me, this gives me a lot of energy to think about this. I feel very, very good. One of the qualities I think that's important to develop also in practice is that it's coupled with metta, but it's just really overarching in the practice in general, is just how to keep the mind positive. Because I think if the mind isn't positive, then it's actually not wholesome. So I might say, having the title of being the abbot of the community, I might hear something, somebody might come to me and say, hey, did you know so-and-so is doing this, so-and-so is doing that? I might think, ugh. But if I keep the mind positive, and this is something I'm just still actively coming to over time, but instead of no worries, it's all good. I'll address that at some point. So because that the unwholesome gets in there, it's very tricky. And to be able to keep the mind positive as much as possible, that's our duty. That's actually our duty as practitioners. It's our duty to keep the mind wholesome, to keep the mind positive, to be practicing that right effort, which we can remember if we say abandoning, restraining, developing, maintaining. That's how we remember right effort, abandoning unwholesome states that have arisen, restraining unwholesome states that so that they don't arise, developing wholesome states that have not yet arisen, maintaining wholesome states that have already arisen. So abandoning, restraining, developing, maintaining. And to not give rise to those unwholesome states, it is tricky. It's the art of practice. So keeping the mind positive and uplifted as much as possible, then there's going to be that sense of friendliness. Keeping the mind humble as much as possible, then there's going to be that sense of being able to not resist when things don't go our way. Being as honest as possible with ourselves and with others. And then we can have a lighthearted attitude toward everything that arises. And we're not going to be going around in a heavy-hearted way, like we have a dark cloud following us, like some sort of, like one of those cartoons, like the cloud just following them. And then we can come together with pure love. I mean, it's sometimes the word love is kind of a hackneyed term, but if there's that purity, then come together in friendliness, and there's a sense of samaki, there's harmony in the community, and we have our differences, we all have our differences, but we can always set those aside. We just have to make that intention, we have to be mindful of it, remind ourselves, establish mindfulness, remind ourselves to be aware of what's happening in the moment, that we can set these things aside. And then we can look at what's important. And it's just the Dhamma, just making the Dhamma important. And sometimes people ask, like, oh, as a senior monk, how do you maintain yourself? How do you sustain yourself? And sometimes, do you develop all sorts of, like, hobbies? Like, we've been doing some welding classes. One of our neighbors teaching us welding, which is quite enjoyable and a very nice thing to learn. But actually, I think that is helpful. These types of things can be helpful, but any skills we develop in the external world, we can't take those with us. So it's Buddha Dhamma Sangha. It's making provisions for the journey. Really, that refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha is what sustains us. It has to be that. It can't be anything else. And that's why we have what we're building up here today. We have this get together with a semi-spontaneous Abhayagiri reunion. So it's just lovely to see everybody. And those are just some reflections coming up with everybody coming together. And I think, uh, I won't go on for too long tonight. I'll just end it there because it'll be nice to enjoy the rest of the quiet evening and get back to our dwelling places and just appreciate the atmosphere. And some of us might want to meet with each other and catch up. So just give that opportunity. I think I'll just leave it there for this evening.